We speak with organizations across the state that help immigrants and other newcomers integrate into the community and find access to services.
We connect the family to the community. A lot of times the families don't know where to go and who are the community members that they should be reaching out to.
We check in with the Syrian Community Network President, Suzanne Akaraz Shalul. We learn about the University YMCA in Champaign's recent designation as a new American Welcome Center. Plus, we speak with WNIJ reporter Sue Stevens about a man from Northern Illinois who was wrongfully convicted of kidnapping and murder 5 years ago and has recently received a certificate of innocence.
What was done to me was criminal. The people who did this to me deserve to go to prison.
Also, we get a preview of the upcoming panel discussions that will be a part of the 19th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival in Champaign, which starts tomorrow. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. In the last 3 months, the Trump administration has tried to put a wide range of measures to restrict immigration to the U.S., whether stopping refugees from coming here or slowing down the process for H-1B visas or making it easier for the federal authorities to deport people. We wanted to ask what it's been like to immigrate to Illinois in this political climate. We are joined now from Urbana by Nadesh Kosi. She immigrated here December of last year from the Congo. Haho from the East Central Illinois Refugee Mutual Assistance Center is also on the line to help with translating. Nadesh, thanks so much for talking with us.
Good morning.
Good morning. So I'd like to start off with just how did you come to live in Illinois?
The way I ended in Illinois is my husband has a friend who lives here. And when we told him that we were giving the authorization to come here, he said that, you know, he invited us to come and stay with him.
Okay. So since you have been here, have you been able to find work and acclimate yourself easily?
Oui, oui. Il a eu, mon mari.
Yes. Myself, I'm not working yet. But my husband has been able to find work easily.
Have you and your husband found that you like living here in Illinois, or has it been difficult adjusting? And if so, what has been the difficult part for you?
I find the United States to be a beautiful country. Unfortunately, we moved here in the midst of winter. And it was so cold, we didn't feel like going out. But despite everything, you know, we feel that this country is very beautiful.
So, Nadesh, what are you hopeful about? Is there anything that you're worried about?
No. Until now, you know, I'm not fearing anything, and I feel good myself.
Nadesh, what would you like people to know about your experience immigrating to the U.S. or the experience of others who have come to the U.S.?
Concerning myself, I have no complaints, especially I found in Mrs. Ho a very good source of help. She has helped me with my documents. Help me doing errands, anything I need, you know, I can turn to her. And she was introduced to me through the host family where we were staying.
That was Nadesh Kosi. She immigrated to the U.S. December of last year from the Congo with translation help from Haho. Thank you to you both for joining us.
Merci à vous aussi. Et merci à Madame Ho.
Thank you to you all, and thank you to Mrs. Ho as well.
And joining me now on the line from Chicago, Suzanne Shaul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Suzanne, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Suzanne, as you were listening to Nadesh there share her experience, what was going through your mind?
First of all, I really liked her story and what she said about how beautiful the country is and how welcoming everyone is. And of course, what struck me is, you know, when she said about the cold, you know, and it's very difficult, you know, when you come from very warm climates and then you have to adjust to a cold climate like Chicago or in central Illinois. And so those first few months, I'm sure, were very difficult for their family. But I'm glad now that the weather's, you know, warming up and things are looking much brighter for them.
Yeah. So kind of building on that idea, what are the main concerns that families have when they come here?
Well, when families first come here, you know, they're in complete shock. You know, no one wants to be a refugee. And when you're a refugee coming to the United States, to resettle in the United States, it means that you've left your loved ones behind. You've left everything behind you. You know, you probably had to flee a few years back and leave your home because of bombing or shelling or whatever the case may be. And you ended up in a host country. And then you, apply through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, the UNHCR, and then to become a refugee, and you went through a long vetting process. So all those hurdles that you had to overcome just to come to the United States. So when you arrive very tired, actually. You know, the refugees that we work with the Syrian Community Network, they all tell us, you know, that you know, we've been in flight mode for years, you know, for the last 2 or 3 years. Even when they go to a host country, those host countries sometimes don't have the resources or the infrastructure to support them so that they can get jobs. Sometimes they're not allowed to get jobs in like Jordan or in Lebanon. There are no jobs. And so they're constantly in flight mode, fight or flight mode. So because they're struggling to make ends meet, but then when they arrive to the United States, they feel a sense of relief, and then all of a sudden they feel exhausted and they, you know, overwhelmed by how much they have to do. The refugees have to come in to learn English. They have to secure a job. They have to, you know, understand the new culture and then the process of, you know, getting their services. You know, this is so it becomes very overwhelming, and they suddenly feel very tired.
Yes. Joining me now in studio as well, we have Ricardo Diaz. He serves on the board of directors at the University YMCA in Champaign and chairs a committee for the New American Welcome Center. Welcome, Ricardo, to the 21st.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. So let's jump over to you for a quick second. The University YMCA here in Champaign is opening this New American Welcome Center. So can you give us an idea of what the center will do, why you're creating it, and what makes it unique versus other services that are available to people here locally?
Yes, actually, we view the Welcome Center as a complement of every other service that's here, from the Refugee Center to the Immigration Project, which are the lawyers. But it comes at a time in which we've been working towards developing a welcoming area, city. And so it seeks to join the services that are going on. Right now, immigrants, if they know that a service exists, they go and, you know, they basically have to track down the services. The Welcome Center will be the first point of contact, and then from there we make references out to the services that are doing it. So it's not so much as a physical center to just come in and be serviced there, but to actually coordinate the services that others are also providing.
So a point of contact, if you may, like a thread that brings it all together.
That joins us all together, especially as to understanding when immigrants come in, depending on their status and the needs that they have. And then also as a follow-up loop with each other, because it's not unusual for an immigrant to contact two agencies and sometimes be working on the same kind of issue for this person, because they didn't know that we were actually two separate agencies. So in this case, we'll be following up so that the person or the agency has the one-on-one correspondence and then the feedback of how that service went.
Okay. And Suzanne, back to you. So you founded the Syrian Community Network. What do you guys do to make sure that coming to and living here in America is easier for Syrians? And how many families have you helped so far?
Well, so far in Chicago, we have about 150 refugee families who have come in, and we help in their adjustment. You know, early on, they come in, you know, very overwhelmed. They have to learn their services. And the resettlement agencies, you know, they're great at going over all the services that they have, you know, helping them with rent and things like that. But, you know, it all goes over their head because, one, there's a language barrier. And then two, they're so overwhelmed when they first arrive that, you know, those things, they kind of miss some of the details. So we have to kind of go over these things again. So we provide the cultural and linguistic support that they need early on in their adjustment. That first year is very difficult. And we also provide mentors who speak Arabic also. We have many mentors who don't speak Arabic as well, and which is great because they're helping them adjust their new land. They, you know, they have to get used to being people with people from different languages and different cultures. And so our mentors also help in that adjustment, you know, taking them to the market, helping them with, you know, filling out applications, helping them find jobs. So those are some of the things that we can help them with. And then in addition to the case management that we, our case managers work with their, you know, individual files, and we help them either a job placement, and we find services for them, we find resources. Whatever we can't do, we outsource out to another organization that we know can provide the services that they badly need.
Okay. Ricardo, so it's my understanding that this new American Welcome Center is just one of six across the country. So I have a few questions. Why did the YMCA want to create this new American Welcome Center collaboration maybe across the U.S., and why here in Champaign-Urbana?
That's right. So the YUSA, which is the entity that links up all the Ys across the nation, has been working on immigration issues for the last several years. We were, our local Y was in Washington a couple of years back when the big conference was there, and visiting senators and basically getting their feet wet on the policy side. However, in New York, the New York YMCA had already had something like a welcome center. And then over the last few years, they've been building several others. But this year, the local YMCA, the local Y, the University Y, was actually chosen. We didn't solicit that. We'd been working locally on immigration issues from sponsoring student groups, Mecha, La Colectiva, to also sponsoring the immigration forum that meets at the Y every second Tuesday. So the local Y had already been working on this, and then the national Y calls us up. We're probably the only university-based Y that is receiving this honor. It comes with some funding, but it also comes from the know-how of the other welcome centers that we'll be seeking to emulate and then adapt to our area as to how to extend the welcome network. You know, as you know, Champaign is the second largest immigrant receiving community in the state. So it's not unusual that we would be highlighted, but to be resourced by National Y is a great, I don't know, a focus of attention for the work that had been previously going on, but now enabling it to expand both the service of referrals, but also the concentration of efforts in this community doing this.
Yeah, so what you were referencing earlier, the U.S. Census Bureau data shows that you Champaign-Urbana is the largest immigrant community in Illinois outside of the Chicago area, correct?
That's right. And, you know, while we've been working through UC Fair to bring in Syrian refugees also, the fact is that not only the university, 10,000 associated foreign-born faculty and students, but, you know, we have almost 25,000 people in this area that are foreign-born. And so while not all of them come to the university, there's lots of them that do, and they bring a great asset and positive energies and talents to this community.
So, Suzanne, in the last 3 months, President Trump, in the last 3 months of President Trump's administration, he's issued two executive orders that have banned travel from seven and then six majority Muslim countries. Then both of those orders were stopped by federal judges. How has that affected what you're able to do in terms of bringing families here to the U.S. and then making sure that their transition here is as smooth as possible?
Obviously, you know, it was really disheartening to see that the ban was, President Trump ordering this ban. But I'm so delighted to see that we have so many of our judges and so many of our community members that stepped up, and we had lawyers and so many advocates saying that this was wrong. And then the hold on the ban, the last hold was in March. It does affect the families who are here in Chicago, because we have families who are waiting for their loved ones to come here. We have one case. Her name is Huda, and she's waiting for her son and her daughter-in-law, who just gave birth a few months back, and they were supposed to travel with them to Chicago in December, but the daughter-in-law was held back because she was about to give birth, and so they said, okay, after it's safe for her to fly after giving birth, they will come, they will join the family, but unfortunately, she has not arrived yet, and you know, there's a risk that her vetting, you know, all of her vetting paperwork that they've gone through, you know, the background checks and the health screenings will all expire, and that means they have to start the process all over again, which will take them much longer to come here. So it does affect families, and so, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, they will, their arrival will be expedited as soon as possible, because there are so many people who are waiting for their loved ones, and I really want to commend the Y and Ricardo for starting this new welcome center. It's really heartwarming to see all this happening across the United States and in small cities like Urbana-Champaign, so it's wonderful.
Yeah, so Suzanne, we only got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break. Real quick, as Trump was on the campaign trail, did you guys start putting anything into place to prepare for something like a travel ban?
No, I mean, we didn't think that he would actually go through it, because there were so many groups who were against, you know, having, you know, not, you know, allowing refugees to come in. And so it was kind of shocking to see that he was going to place the ban on, and specifically on Syrian refugees. But I'm really happy to see that the community really spoke out, and everybody was advocating for people to come in as refugees. The only bad, but you know, one.
Suzanne, I am going to have to cut you off here for just a second. I would like to continue this conversation here in just a moment. We've been talking about immigrating to Illinois, in particular with Ricardo Diaz, who's on the board of directors at the University YMCA in Champaign and chairs a committee for the New American Welcome Center, and Suzanne Shaul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network in Chicago. We are going to continue our conversation with both of you next. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned to the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. We are continuing our conversation about what it's been like to immigrate to Illinois in this particular political climate. I'm joined in studio by Ricardo Diaz from the University YMCA in Champaign and the New American Welcome Center. And on the line, we have Suzanne Shaul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Thanks for sticking with us. Ricardo, there's been a family who's reached out to the University YMCA from Central America. What was their experience coming to Illinois? What's their story?
You know, this particular lady called me up last week because she'd seen about the ICE raids coming into the area. And so she called up and she said, I want to help. She says, I have my green card. My husband does too. But it's so hard to get here, and she could feel the fear in the community around her. Her story was actually kind of sad, because they won their green cards while they were still living in Central America, and then they sold everything they had. They had savings. They had a good job, but just the violence. They wanted to get out, and they won the green cards. So. When they got to Miami, they thought everything would go well, but they put their money, you know, somebody invited them to an investment because, you know, you're newcomers, this is the way to make it in America. And sad story is that they lost all their money. They got defrauded of their money. It became really hard for them, because now what do? They don't, you know, they barely had a little bit of the language, and they were... Miami's very expensive, as they found out that they were others. They put out their feelers. They eventually got offered a job in L.A. He's actually in radio. And when they get to L.A., the job is really, you know, not at all what was promised. So now they're in L.A., which is just as expensive as Miami, and they can't figure out what, you know, they were ready to go home. Had it not been for a friend from back home that told them, you might want to try Champaign because of the university I went there. It's a nice place. It's peaceful and it's not very expensive. So they arrived here about 6 months ago. And they're, as she listened to the other things that were going on, she says, I want to help. I don't want to be, I don't want other people to go through what we went through. It's going to get better. We know it just can't stay like this. She's heard good things, and as she settles here, she called up to help. And it's the kind of goodwill that is not unusual in this community, but from a newcomer that has just suffered quite a bit in getting adjusted, it's even nicer because once you've felt it, you can't help but say, when you see a new person arriving and having all the problems, saying it's okay, it can't really be that bad.
Hearing it from someone's perspective who's been through it has got to be so much more powerful, in their message. And it's also very inspiring to hear that these people who have gone through so much just want to help someone else avoid that together. So, Suzanne, is that similar in the Syrian community, that people who immigrated here maybe a few years ago or even recently want to step up and help other new immigrants coming in?
Yeah, many of the refugees who came to Chicago, they always ask me, what help do you need? What services do you need? I can pick up furniture. I can pick up clothes. I can, drive someone. And so this is, it's really good. It shows, that they are helping and supporting others who came in, and so that they don't go through the hardships that they went through. We just moved into our new center in Chicago, Northern Chicago. We have our open houses this Friday from 5 to 7. So if anybody wants to attend our open house. But many of the refugee families have reached out, what can we do for you? We just want to do something for you. I asked them, can you do this? Can you do that? And they're gladly step in because they saw how much the community reached out and to help them. And so now they want to pay it forward and want to give back. And that's really good.
And speaking of that idea of giving back to the community, we'll start with Ricardo, you first, and then we'll go to Suzanne. For the people who are listening right now and wondering how it is that they can get involved, whether that's through directly your services or in more general terms, what would you tell them?
So there are several ways to help out. The caveat is many people want to help and be in contact with immigrants right away. There's a great satisfaction in that. But we've learned over time that it's better to take in that goodwill and have them go through a small training. So if they'll go to the University Y website or the UC Immigration Forum website, that there's links there to get connected, to fill out the it's not an application, but to fill out a sheet to tell us what their interests are and what they can do. And as they do, then they'll be ready. They're better able to process. There's a great difference between a refugee and someone who's overstayed or someone who walked across the border. The fears, the sensitivity, the privacy that needs to be respected. So as people get a little bit more experience, then, it's not that they need us to contact immigrants, but it's better that when we as organizations become the conduit to other immigrants.
It's in a more official channel, right? Just making sure that everyone respected and properly handled or taken care of.
No, especially because people come from very traumatic situations. There is a reason why they are afraid of anything that looks like official. The law,
right.
Or the other way around, that they're very, very happy to let the officials do the work. And as I think Suzanne probably has the experience, while we want to help people transition, we also don't want them to learn that this is a dependency situation. We want to help them transition into becoming regular people that also work their way through.
Suzanne, do you find that to be your experience as well?
Yes, many people want to help, and we sometimes are overwhelmed with the response that of people filling out the volunteer forms, and so we too have a volunteer training, and then we also do a background check because we don't, as Ricardo mentioned, we don't want anyone to get hurt from anyone who is showing goodwill or trying to volunteer or trying to help, but then they end up hurting the family, and so we train the volunteers on what to do, do's and don'ts, and then we do the background checks, and that ensures the safety of the children, because there's so many adults who want to help children with their homework and things like that. So we want to make sure that everyone is safe. And it's been really great. You know, we've had a few mishaps here and there, just, you know, with timing and some families who don't understand the power of volunteers, what volunteers can bring to them. But then with time, you know, those things have, you know, cleared their way. And now the families really appreciate the time that the volunteers are coming to spend with them when they take them out to a museum or they take them out to a picnic or invite them to a holiday dinner. I think they show a lot of appreciation, and they've learned so much about the culture, about the American culture, through these interactions and through being welcomed to a new community. And I think it's a really powerful experience. And you know, for whether you're an immigrant or you're an undocumented or you're a refugee or whoever you are, I think all of us are looking for people to welcome us and to champion this idea of welcoming the newcomer. I came here as an immigrant. I came as a child at the age of 10, and I remember the people who reached out to us and who invited us. I still remember them. I still remember the people who really impacted my life for the positive. And I think whether they're refugees or they're undocumented or just new immigrants, they will remember these experiences and these things that will happen, positive things that will happen to them forever. And they will try to give back later on when they are more adjusted. Just like when we started the Syrian Community Network, we felt we needed to give back to the people who, you know, helped us.
Yeah, we've been talking about immigrating to Illinois with Ricardo Diaz, who's on the board of directors at the University YMCA here in Champaign and chairs the committee for the New American Welcome Center, and Suzanne Shaul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network in Chicago. Ricardo, Suzanne, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In 1957, 7-year-old Maria Rudolph was kidnapped and murdered. Her family has been trying to piece together what happened ever since. In 2012, it seemed like state authorities had finally figured it out. Jack McCullough was eventually tried and convicted for Maria's murder in DeKalb County Court. And 4 years into a life sentence, his conviction was overturned, and McCullough was released from prison just last year. Now, the 77-year-old man has been granted an official certificate of innocence by DeKalb County. Here to tell us more about this story from DeKalb is WNIJ reporter Sue Stevens. Sue, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, thanks, Liz.
Thank you. So first off, this kidnapping and murder happened in 1957, but yet Jack McCullough wasn't convicted until 2012. So do you have any sense of what made this case so hard to solve?
Just the fact that it was so old. The evidence was gone. This is a case that really captivated the nation when it happened in 1957. And so, you know, there was a lot of evidence gathered then, and then everything just kind of went cold. They talked with all sorts of people from all over the country as suspects, but nothing ever panned out. And then it wasn't until just, you know, a few years ago that new evidence seemed to appear and the case was looked at again. And that's when they saw Jack McCullough as a suspect in it again. He was a neighbor of the Rudolph family at the time of the kidnapping and the murder.
So this official certificate of innocence, I had never heard, I must admit, of anything like this. So will it make it easier for Jack McCullough to not be weighed down by his prison sentence as he tries to participate in society again?
Yeah, that's the point of it. And that's really important, especially for younger people this happens to. He's 77 years old right now. So he's retired. He, a certificate of innocence usually it clears your name, so people okay. are able to pursue jobs and do things that someone with a criminal conviction for murder might not be able to otherwise. It also makes them eligible for restitution from the state of Illinois as well. And for him, that means $85,000 in restitution because he did 4 years. Had he done longer, he would have been eligible for more money. This also clears the way for big lawsuits against the state and local officials.
So, Sue, if we could briefly kind of backtrack a little bit so that our listeners understand. So what exactly made him convicted guilty, you know, a couple years ago, and then within 4 years that was overturned?
He was convicted on There was when at the time that Maria Rudolph was kidnapped, a neighbor, a little neighbor girl, was playing with her. So this, you know, so many years, decades later, she was shown lineups that included a photo of him and then some other guys who would have been about the age at the time, and she picked him out of that lineup. It was really a textbook case of a bad lineup, really done improperly. Also, there was talk about an ex-girlfriend who had a train ticket that he had hold for her, but that turned into actually evidence in support of his innocence later, but that was kept out of the trial. So really it was looking back at some old FBI records, not paying attention to some of the things that the FBI records said about timelines, and going with this this neighbor girl's memory from, you know, 50 years earlier.
Right. So it's also important to note that this is still an unsolved case for the family of Maria Rudolph. So let's listen to what DeKalb County State's Attorney Rick Amato had to say last week when the Judge Brady had all the parties back in court to announce his decision regarding the certificate of innocence.
Jack McCullough, his loved ones, his lawyers have talked a lot about justice in the last year or so. Maria Rudolph, her brother Chuck, and her sister Pat don't have justice.
So I imagine the family thought that they had closure when Jack McCullough was convicted. What was their reaction when they learned that Jack would be released and that he would receive the certificate of innocence?
Her brother, who had been in court all the time and really fighting this, had last year decided that he was done. He couldn't take it anymore and had decided to move on with his life. Her sister did keep coming to court with her family and friends, and her response right afterward was she was very, very disappointed. She still thinks he's the one who did it. Now, I did fail to say that his case was overturned because another state's attorney last year had to review the case by court order and showed all this evidence that showed that Jack McCullough was actually in Rockford, had made a collect phone call to his parents at the time that Maria Rudolph was kidnapped. So that was withheld in court when he was convicted and brought out again, and that's why he was released.
Okay. So obviously, Jack McCullough always going through a range of emotions, I'm sure. And after that same hearing last week, he spoke with reporters outside the courthouse. Here's a portion of what he shared.
My daughter's children were 6 and 11 when I left. They were teenagers. They were teenagers when I got home. They took that from me. I cannot forgive them for that.
So I know we don't have a whole lot of time here left, but that's so difficult to hear because you really empathize with both sides, the family and with Jack.
Yeah.
So what happens next for the family and for Jack? I understand that Jack is preparing a lawsuit, but what are these next steps for them?
Well, I'm not sure what the family is going to do at this point. Jack McCullough, the case, like you said, is still open. And Jack McCullough has written a book. Or he's in the process of writing a book, so that's going on. He lives in Seattle now. He'll also probably be back. He said he wants justice. He will be back. And so that's what we have coming up with the federal lawsuits against Illinois State Police and a lot of other entities, including local state's attorneys and other assistants in their offices.
We've been talking with WNIJ reporter Sue Stevens about a man from Northern Illinois who is wrongfully convicted of a kidnapping and murder, but has recently received a certificate of innocence. Sue, thanks so much for sharing this story with us and giving us some perspective today here on the 21st.
You're welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 19th annual Roger Ebert Film Festival kicks off tomorrow in Champaign. And this year's festival is centered around themes of kindness, compassion, and empathy. We've heard a little bit about those films that will be featured this week during Nyla's interview with festival co-founder and host Chaz Ebert during yesterday's show. And today, we thought we'd give you a preview of several of the panel discussions that will be included as a part of Ebert Fest. The panels are free and open to the public. We'll be tweeting about that information. You can follow us the 21st at 21ST Show. We'll also have all that information available on our website. But to help us learn more about these panels, I'm joined now on the line by Nate Cohn, director of Ebert Fest. Also joining us on the line from Chicago is Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips. Nate, Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
So, Thank Nate, let's start with you. Why the emphasis on empathy and compassion for this year's festival?
Well, we always dedicate the festival, or at least we have for the past few years, to someone. Usually it's an individual. This year, we decided to do it, to dedicate the festival to the principles of empathy, compassion. And so we thought we'd take the opportunity to tailor the panels to those particular topics.
Okay. Michael, what about films in particular do you think make them so powerful in the realm of these themes of empathy and compassion and kindness?
This is the great thing about Roger Ebert. You know, he was known for so many different achievements and ideas and passions and so many of them right from the beginning with him as a critic and just as a human being were kind of oriented this way. And he's kind of phrased this differently over the years, but this idea that movies are this machine that generates empathy. He's also, you know, said that empathy is the most essential quality of civilization. You know, two things come to mind right now. We've never needed it more right now in the American body politic. The movies, you know, the certain types of movies really do take care of themselves. And I love a great big idiot blockbuster as much as anybody. they tend not to revolve around those themes we're talking about. So it's just good to see in this year's lineup in particular, I think, and maybe Nate can talk to more about how it came together. You know, just a wide variety of films that kind of express some aspect or another of this. And they don't, it doesn't mean that the films are just medicine, that they're good for you and that they don't engage dramatically. And we have all kinds of different storytelling and, you know, we got a couple of musicals and it's just too big to generalize about, which is great.
Yeah, and that's the power of movies, right? They're oftentimes too big to generalize, but they're such an experience for the viewer. Nate, what kind of conversations do you hope to spark with not only your panel guests, but also the audience during the panel that Michael's going to be joining you for, 2 hours in someone else's shoes?
That's a phrase that Roger used a lot, 2 hours in someone else's shoes, which is basically the length of time it takes to watch most movies. And Roger always said, you know, you go into a movie with you go in with a blank slate, expecting nothing, and you let the movie wash over you and you see how it changes you. And so that's generally the topic we're going to be talking about, mainly with filmmakers. You know, how conscious are they of this, of the power of empathy in films when they're making their films or when they're acting in them? Do they understand the, you know, the power that they have in making these entertainments? So on our panel, we're going to have a number of actors and directors, including Michael Phillips, but we're also going to have Tanya Wexler, who directed the film Hysteria, Hugh Dancy, who stars in that film, Michael Hausman, Michael Butler, both producers on Hair, Charles Burnett, who directed To Sleep With Anger, and a couple of scholars and film critics, Sheila O'Malley and Richard Newport. So it's a wide ranging group of people to talk about a rather general subject. We really never know where these panels are going to go when we start them. But generally, they end up in an exciting and interesting place.
Yeah, that's the beauty about a panel discussion, especially when you're able to bring together such an eclectic group of people for that conversation. And Michael Biehn, the film critic on the panel, what are you hoping that the audience will walk away from as far
as... I was going to tell Nate that I was under a misunderstanding. I thought this panel was just 2 hours in my shoes and mine alone. So I'm not... I got to rethink this a little bit.
We'll do that on stage at the festival.
Okay.
You can just give out your shoes to anybody who's willing.
Yeah. Maybe about 9 a.m. before everybody comes in. I think, what Nate says about the panel is absolutely true. As a civilian, just as an interested movie lover, I've sat in on all kinds of panels at Ebert Fest that I haven't been a part of. And you just can't, there's... You have 8, 9, 10 really vital, interesting voices kind of just talking about what's on their mind on this subject. And, movies don't respond as quickly to what's happening in the world as other mediums. That's not what they do. You know, they don't, that's what other mediums do better. But what movies can do is take a half second and think about what the right movie maker can take a half second and think about what they need, what she or he needs to say about whatever they're writing about, the people they're writing about, the book they're adapting, whatever, and or just the world we're living in right now, and then make something of it. And then 6, 9, 12 months later, we all get a look at it. And then, of course, now at Ebert Fest, we're looking at films that are, 20, 30, 40 years old, and a lot of them being there. And To Sleep With Anger, as Nate mentioned, which is, Charles Burnett's a fantastic American filmmaker. If you go back to Killer of Sheep, which he made back in the 70s, is that right, Nate? I think late 70s?
Go ahead. Sorry, Nate.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that films take on different meanings depending what you bring to the viewing experience and what the... Michael mentioned the body politic. What's going on in our lives at the moment, we bring to the viewing experience, and what we take away from the movie this time might be something completely different than we took away from it when it was made 20 years ago.
Absolutely. In fact, each viewer can have a very different viewing experience within, everyone coming together and watching it together. And then the ways in which you evolve as you watch it over time can change too. So, Michael, that dovetails into something I'm curious about. Is there a movie that stands out to you as an example of the power that film can have to change us as a viewer, especially when it comes to compassion, empathy, these themes for the festival?
God, so many. If you're just looking at this year, there are films. What I love about the opening night selection for among other things, Hair, is that Hair is a movie. Everybody knows the songs, right? Aquarius, About the Sunshine, and I mean, it's a fantastic score. It was all over the culture in the 1960s, and then by the time the movie came out in 1979. It wasn't its time yet. People were more interested in the movie that came out the year before, Grease. It was more about that kind of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And Hair's a different kind of period piece. And I just think where we are now and kind of, how divided this country is right now. And even among all the good hundreds of moviegoers that come through Ebert Fest, you're going to get a pretty wide variety of opinions and experiences. And I'm just really eager to see how that film interacts with the crowd, and I think it ends on a note of like, we have to solve our problems if we're going to move ahead together as a people. And I don't know. I really, and of course it's just quote, just entertainment, but I don't know. Not all entertainments are created equal, and I'm very interested to see how this one holds up.
That's true. They are not. And films, as we've been talking about, can powerfully promote empathy for other people within you know, kind of the human being sector, but they can also promote empathy for the universe, which is why I wanted to bring another person into our discussion today about these upcoming panels planned for the 2017 Roger Ebert Film Festival. Bill Gropp is a professor of computer science and the acting director of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois. He'll be speaking as a part of the panel this Friday entitled Empathy for the Universe, and he joins us now in studio. Bill, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, Bill, going right to you, what do you hope to be the message of this week's panel that you're involved in? What's your personal message?
So, my message is that to have this sort of empathy for the universe, to understand our place and our responsibilities and roles in, you know, in the environment, in the world, the universe at large, to really have empathy, you have to have understanding. You have to have feeling. You have to be, well, as has been described, you have to be in someone else's shoes. And it's very important, I think, for everyone to understand that they can understand. And computation and visualization, use of visual arts to help in that understanding and to develop that feeling is something that I think is really important. It's something that we've invested a lot in. And it's an example of how everyone can learn to connect to the whole universe.
Yeah, and building on that, what role do you believe scientists can play in creating these films, particularly films about the universe that you're talking about? What's their role in all of this?
So their role is to explain things to the public so that we can all understand and to bring truth into that imagery, the explanations, so that we can really grasp how things work as a whole. So in a movie like the Hubble IMAX movie, where you get to see the birthplace of stars, to grasp how awesome that is and how that comes together, that helps you develop that sort of feeling for our place in the universe. Other computations, other visualizations that help us see how climate evolves. It helps us see how populations move. Helps us understand how drugs work in the body, and so that we can better understand how to come up with cures. Those things can all be explained to the public so that we don't fear them. We understand them. We can learn how to work with them. We can be part of a participation in greater knowledge, greater understanding, greater feeling.
Yeah. And real quick, before we wrap up, I'm actually just really curious about this. When you started on your career path years ago, did you think that film would have a part in helping the world understand what it is that you do?
I didn't, and I should have, because films are always so powerful for us that scientists will do these visualizations and see things that they've never seen before, never understood before. And the same thing happens when we do these films to communicate to the public. When I see them as a scientist, I see things that I haven't seen before. I see connections that
That's
I haven't
amazing.
Seen before. And so the ability of the visual arts to reach us in a way that nothing else can accomplish is really amazing.
Well, thanks so much to all of you guys. That's all the time we have for today, sadly. We've been talking with the director of Ebert Fest, Nate Cohn, Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips, and acting director of NCSA, Bill Gropp, about the upcoming panels at the Roger Ebert Film Festival. Nate, Michael, Bill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to you.
You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and other ways to connect with us via phone, email, or social media, all on our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter, search 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments for things that you'd like us to ask on the air. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Liz Westfield. In for Nyla Boodoo, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.